Hello, good evening, good day, everybody. Welcome to the Indian Interest Podcast, episode 11. It's great to be back on the live streams again. I hope you're all doing very well. So before we begin, as always, let me see who all is there on the live chat with us. Let me greet you all. I can see Keshav, Tarun, Amit, Jasmine, Shravani, Cyberboy, Yash Rao, Aditya, Durga, CP Verma, Super Rex, Challenge Accepted, Grave Walker, Charvaka, Overlord, Shamik, Akash, Prajwal, Mayank, Error, Bharti, Krati, Keshav, Anahita, Tarun, Ayan, MT Divine, Amit, Avneet Singh, Akshar, Anirudh, Nishtha, FG, Bot Gaming, Akhil, Jayesh, Upreti, Vanos, Spot, Jeevan, Manav, Rogue Gamer, Akshay Kumar, Asminor, Pratham, Pranay, Shubham, Rahul, Haripriya, Satvik, Purobi, Chiching, Romeo, Seoram, Lage Raho Online, Rajat, Steve, Alok, Vladimir, Vladimirovich, Putin, Avishek Sarkar, Somnath, Rajat, Manmat, Arya Divan, Sin Royalty, Bharat Patel, and lots of other people. Good evening, good day to all of you, and thank you so much for being on this live stream, this wonderful, fine evening here. So, as always, we have a number of things to discuss, lots of interesting and important events happening all over the world. And the Indian Interest Podcast is all about looking at the world from the perspective of the Indian national interest to see what these events are going to mean for India and for the world, yeah, but primarily from the Indian perspective. So what shall we begin with? What's happening in the world? I can see there's a lot of chatter on the channel and other places as well about the Ukraine war, the Ukraine conflict, and especially about the ongoing withdrawal of the Russian forces from the Kherson region. And that raises a lot of important questions for us, right? So what's happening? We know that the Russians are withdrawing from the Kherson region. I'll put that on the map very, very soon. So we know the Russians are withdrawing from Kherson. They have announced a withdrawal and they are withdrawing, I think, right now. It's ongoing as we speak. So what does it mean? Does it mean that we are witnessing a Russian defeat? If not that, are we witnessing a significant sign of Russian weakness? Has the tide turned in favor of NATO? This withdrawal from Kherson, how will India interpret it? How should India interpret it? And how should China interpret it? How will the big BRICS coalition of nations interpret this Russian withdrawal from the Kherson region? Does this signify a loss of reputation and prestige for Vladimir Putin? So these are the questions that we need to look into. So let me first put the thing on the map. I mean, let's take a look at the map of the region so that we understand what we are talking about. So this obviously is the map. I am sure by now you're all familiar with it. We are looking at India. Let's go westwards. We know what comes next. Yeah, so we go westwards and we reach the Mediterranean and Black Sea region. Yes, north of the present-day nation of Turkey. So the this is the map of Ukraine and the Black Sea region, and that's where the conflict is ongoing. Now, as usual, I've got some internet issue. Let me take a look at the chat. Is there any lag that we are witnessing? Are you? Just let me know in the comments if there is any lag or any issue in the image. Is the image clear? Is there an issue? Not sure if there's a lag. There's a lag. Unfortunately, there's a lag. Let me see what I can do about it. Okay, I think it's fine now. So let's take a look at the Kherson region. Where is Kherson? So first of all, we are looking at the map of Ukraine. Once again, there is a lag. Let me just take a look if I can fix the lag. There are these issues once in a while. I need to look into why it is so. I think it's still lagging. It's still lagging, is it? Yeah, it looks like the lag is still continuing. It's a big lag. Somebody is saying lag is destroying the moment. Lag. Let's see. The connection seems to be fairly unstable. Just give me a moment. I will try and fix this issue. It's fine now. Right. Just let me try and fix that thing. Okay, people are saying it's fine now. The voice is 5G. I have 5G, but still not fine. Happening. Okay, I think it is fine now. It's stable now. All right. So, okay, let me just restart the whole thing. So we are talking about the Kherson. Is the image fine now? I think it's fine now. I think it seems to be fine now. Just let me know if in the comments if it is fine. I think it's fine. Then we will restart the whole thing. Audio fine, video freezing. I think it's fine now. Yes. I think if you can see my hand moving around, yes, I think it's fine. All right. Okay, so let me just get into this again. So the question is about the Kherson withdrawal of the Russians. It has now been announced by the Russian government that they are withdrawing from the Kherson region in Ukraine, right? The Russian armed forces are withdrawing from Kherson. So what does it mean? How are we to interpret this? Does it mean that the Russians are facing a defeat? Is this indicative of a Russian defeat in the Kherson region? And does it indicate that this is a significant sign of Russian weakness? Right? Are we witnessing a significant Russian weakness that is being exposed now by the NATO coalition of forces in Ukraine? Does it mean that the tide has turned in favor of NATO? Right? That's another question. And then we have to look at it from India's perspective. How should India interpret what we are witnessing right now? How should China interpret what this Russian withdrawal from Kherson? Right? And how should the BRICS nations interpret this? And does this represent a loss of reputation and a loss of prestige for Vladimir Putin? So these are the questions. So let's take a look at the map. We are seeing a map of the Ukraine region, the Black Sea region, and let's see where Kherson is. So this here is the city of Kherson. And Kherson is essentially a province. It is named after the city. So the Kherson province is where the Russians are withdrawing from, not from the entire province, but from the right bank or the western bank of the river Dnieper, right? So that's what we are witnessing. Now, we also know that 2 months ago, the Russians also withdrew from the Kharkiv region in northeastern Ukraine, essentially in eastern Ukraine. That was approximately around the time of around 10th of September 2022, right? And the conflict started on February 24, 2022, with this, which Vladimir Putin called his special operation in Ukraine. At the end of September, we had the annexation of 4 provinces or regions of Ukraine: Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia. So, which made these regions part of Russia? The Russians call it the reunification of these regions with Russia. And I had said at the time that these regions now fall under the Russian nuclear umbrella. So if anybody tries to take these regions, there the Russians may possibly resort to, if required, potentially the use of nuclear weapons, possibly, potentially, right? So these regions, once that they are part officially of Russia, they fall under the Russian nuclear umbrella. And now we are witnessing the withdrawal of the Russian forces from the right bank or the western bank of the Dnieper River in the Kherson province. So that's and this was announced in a televised address by the commander of the Russian armed forces, General Sergei Surkovinin. Surovikin, I think his name is, right? And it was also announced by the Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu in a televised address. So it's clear that the Russians are withdrawing, and the withdrawal is ongoing right now. So let's take a look at what the Americans are saying about this. So let me put that on the screen. A tweet by the Study of War, the ISW, the Institute for the Study of War, which is an American organization. So they have put up these maps of what's happening in the Kherson region. Once the map loads, we shall take a look at it. It looks like it's taking a while. Here it is. So this is the situation, and they have put up some more images, right? So this tweet was on November 12, which is essentially yesterday. So they are saying that Ukrainian forces are completing the liberation of the western bank of the Kherson Oblast after the Russians retreated from it, right? And let's take a look at a better map so that we understand in detail what's happening. Let's do that. So I have this image here that I shall put on the screen. Here we are. Okay, I think this will give you a good example, a good idea of what's happening. So the dark red region with the stripes is the Crimean Peninsula, which is occupied by Russia since 2014. The red regions are occupied by Russia, basically annexed by the Russians. The blue region is where you have Ukrainian reported counteroffensive, and we have the Kherson city, the city of Kherson here. And we are witnessing over here, the striped region is where the Russians are withdrawing from. So that is the situation right now. So what are we to understand this, understand from what's happening? So first of all, let's understand what this war is all about, right? Russia and Ukraine are fighting two very different conflicts. Russia, as we know, has refrained from waging what the Americans call total war on Ukraine. The Americans have this, it's a concept that I think the Chinese first came up with, but it's called total war, which means you use every resource at your disposal, the army, the navy, the air force, every single thing at your disposal to completely annihilate the nation. Shock and awe. That's an American term. And that's what the Americans did in Iraq, for instance, right? When they essentially flattened Iraq and Baghdad in the first 24 to 48 hours of the second Iraq conflict, right? Just carpet bombing everything, flattening everything. The Russians have refrained from waging this sort of war against Ukraine. And Russia, as we know, has refused to commit even 5% of its air force in the Ukraine conflict. The Russians are essentially fighting, in a sense, with one hand tied behind their back. They have voluntarily decided to do this, right? So on the one hand, the Russians are refraining from doing all this. They are refusing to use the air force at all. They're using a couple of, a few fighter aircraft here and there, and a few helicopters, right? And that's what we are seeing. And they're not using the bulk of their air force, which is very, very powerful. And on the other hand, we have NATO. So the Ukrainian armed forces are essentially NATO armed forces. It's a whole coalition of nations. What we are seeing is that NATO is continuously replenishing and resupplying and bolstering Ukraine's military capabilities. We are witnessing the classic proxy warfare. It's a proxy war. We witnessed a proxy war in the Kashmir region of India, right, where the Pakistanis, financed by the US, waged for a proxy war in the region, even in Punjab region, for a very long time. Even now, there is a low intensity kind of proxy warfare going on there. Whatever terrorist activities happen in Kashmir from time to time sporadically are part of that proxy war. But in Ukraine, we are witnessing a full-scale proxy war. The Ukrainian armed forces they exist and they are being replenished by NATO. Constantly, continuously, with a whole lot of arms and ammunition, etc., is flowing into Ukraine. So that's why the Ukrainian armed forces are there, right? So Ukraine is fighting total war, all out war with essentially unlimited resources. It is throwing essentially unlimited men into the war, into the meat grinder of war. And that's what we witnessed in the Kharkiv region, and that's what we're witnessing in other places as well. On the other hand, the Russians are constrained, they are restricted. It's a military operation that is designed to minimize collateral damage, minimize damage to infrastructure and civilians. Of course, some of that will happen. It's a war. You can't ensure that no civilian ever dies, but that's how it is. That's the nature of war. The other thing we are witnessing, the other difference is that the Ukrainians are fighting on their own territory. The Russians are essentially fighting on NATO territory, NATO-occupied territory or enemy territory, right? So that's where we are. So that's what's happening. So what are the scenarios that we can see? What are the possible scenarios? We are witnessing an undoubted Russian withdrawal from a region it recently declared to have been reunified with Russia. So just recently they declared it's reunified after the referendum, and now they are withdrawing from essentially a third or a quarter of the Kherson Oblast. So one scenario, the more likely scenario, is that NATO is winning and Russia is losing this particular segment of the conflict. Right, and if this is correct, then we will witness, if this scenario is correct, that Russia is losing and NATO is winning, then we will see in the next few days Ukraine attempting to cross the river Dnieper and try to move on Crimea. So as you can see in the map, the Dnieper River is the fourth largest, I think the fourth largest river in Europe, right? So the city of Kherson lies on the west bank of this river. That's where the Russians are withdrawing from. They are crossing the river and going eastwards. So if it is indeed a case of Russia losing because they are incapable of fighting and NATO winning, then in the next few days we will witness, but possibly, the Ukrainians trying to cross the river and get into the southern part of the Kherson Oblast and maybe even try to make a military march or a move on Crimea itself. So that is the first possibility, the first scenario. The second scenario is that there are attempts to agree upon a ceasefire. You know, most diplomacy happens in secrecy. Diplomacy always happens behind the scenes. It's only when something is agreed upon that it is made public. So maybe there is backdoor diplomacy happening. Maybe a third party, a third nation may be involved in negotiating and brokering a ceasefire for the conflict. And maybe one of the conditions or preconditions or prerequisites of this future ceasefire is that Russia should withdraw from this portion of the Kherson Oblast. Possibly. So that is the second possibility, that there are secret negotiations happening, and maybe this is one of the requirements for a ceasefire. So if this scenario is correct, you may see this fructifying during the G20 summit, which is going to happen next week, 15, 16 November, right? Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, somewhere there. And so if this is the case, then this ceasefire could fructify during or soon after the G20 summit, which is coming up next week. So possibility one, scenario one, is that NATO is winning, Russia is losing, in which case you will see the Ukrainian armed forces try to cross over the river and try to make a move on Crimea, and they will definitely bombard Crimea with their artillery, because now Crimea is in range of their long-range artillery. The second scenario is that there is a potential ceasefire coming up, and this is a prerequisite of the ceasefire. The third possibility is that this is a nasty trap for NATO. The Russians are laying a trap. You know, in one of the classic military strategies is the false withdrawal. It's a tactic that makes the opposition armed forces get into a territory where then you can turn the tide and try to annihilate them. So this is a rather unlikely scenario. The potential or probability of this is low. But yes, one has to consider this as well, that this is a nasty trap that the Russians have planted for NATO. I would say that the most likely two scenarios is that either the Russians are losing this part of the conflict or there are secret negotiations for a ceasefire, in which case this could be one of the potential prerequisites for the ceasefire, that Russia should withdraw from this part of the Ukrainian territory, right? So what does this all mean? Is this a Russian defeat? We still don't know. The next forthcoming days will tell us what really happened. it's a Russian defeat or it's a tactical withdrawal, a trap, or a ceasefire is coming up. We still don't know. Is it a sign of Russian weakness? Possibly a sign of Russian weakness. It doesn't mean that the war is over and the Russians have lost. A war can go on for months, years. I'm not sure we are anywhere close to the conflict, the end of the conflict. Obviously, we know that, like everyone is saying, these is winter is coming, and the Russians will utilize the cold of the winter to pressurize Europe and the people of Europe to get certain concessions and end the war in favor of Russia in some way or the other. So it could possibly be a sign of Russian weakness. Has the tide turned in favor of NATO? Or we still have to see about that. The next few days, the next coming days and maybe a couple of weeks will tell us clearly where we are. How should India and China interpret this? India and China will be obviously in touch with all the sides. Dr. Jaishankar and Mr. Wang Yi of China, these are the two respective foreign ministers. They will be in touch with their Russian counterpart. And I'm sure at a higher level also, there could be communications. So, India and China will be watching this very carefully, very closely. Yes, it is obviously best for the non-superpower great powers of the world that this conflict does not go too long. It does not, become a catastrophe, or there should be no crossing of the nuclear threshold or any of that. And obviously, we would like to see a ceasefire, maybe around this time. Yeah. And along the lines that of control that we have. So it's something that India and China will both be observing very closely. Is this a loss of reputation for Vladimir Putin? The Western media is trying to make it look like that. Yeah, there are even some reports in the Western media that Alexander Dugin, who is one of the famous philosophers and geostrategist, nationalist, they call him an ultra-right-wing nationalist geopolitical strategist, right? So there are reports in the Western media that Alexander Dugin, who recently lost his daughter in a terrorist attack, there are reports that he has called for the removal and possibly even killing of Vladimir Putin. So that's what the Western media is reporting. Now, we have to take these reports with a grain of salt because all media is these days propaganda. Please understand that. So my perspective is very clear. We have to wait and watch. There could be three or four different scenarios being played out. Each of these scenarios has a certain possibility. The most probable scenario is that Russia is currently at this time showing weakness in this region and they are being forced to withdraw. That is one possibility. The other possibility, which also is significantly possible, is that there could be a ceasefire coming up. Yeah, and the least likely possibility is that the Russians have laid a trap for the Ukrainians. So let's keep an eye on this. We're going to keep on watching this. So these are the possible scenarios that we are witnessing. Winter is coming. This could get very long and very, very... winter is typically brutal in these regions. Yeah. So, yeah, there are all kinds of possible scenarios open. I don't think Russia is on the brink of defeat or anything. The first thing we have to understand is Russia is fighting on enemy territory. No actual Russian territory apart from the annexed regions is facing they're not facing any loss of territory. So that's where we are. And the important thing from Russia's perspective, if you look at it, is that their entire air force is sitting, not idle, it is sitting in reserve. And why is Mr. Putin not using his air force? Because he is saving it for a future actual conflict with NATO. That's what we are seeing. So so that's the scenario, right? We still don't know where we are. We still don't know what's happening. But these are the potential scenarios. Let's wait for a week. Let's wait for the G20 summit to happen. Let's wait for a week after that. And then we will have much more clarity. So in the next episode of The Indian Interest, I will revisit this question of what happened and what's happening in the Kherson region. But that is where we are for now. And that is the analysis that I can offer to you. Right? So yeah, that is about Kherson. I think a lot of people... ask me this question. I may take it again tomorrow if there is more clarity on this on tomorrow's Ask Abhijit session. But yeah, that's where we are for now about Kherson. Now, let's talk about BRICS. So let's talk about BRICS. And as we know, so let me again, once again, put a news report on the screen. One second. Just give me a second. Let me do that. Right. So there are reports of a potential possible expansion of BRICS. Here is one of those reports. The new candidate countries for BRICS expansion. If accepted, the new proposed BRICS members would create an entity with a GDP 30% larger than the United States, over 50% of the global population, and in control of 60% of the global gas reserves, and so on and so forth. So this is about the possible expansion of BRICS. I'm not sure if there was a map there, but let's try and refresh the page and see if there is a map of the nations that could possibly be part of the future BRICS thing. Okay, so So one is we are hearing reports of a potential expansion of BRICS. Let me put another news report on the screen. This is from some time ago, but it's relevant, obviously. So this report that I'm putting on the screen is from June 2022. BRICS nations to continue discussion on expansion process. This is a declaration. The leaders of the five nations said that they would continue to discuss the possibility of admitting new countries of the five nation grouping on the basis of full consultation and consensus and so on and so forth. Yeah, so that is the news. So now the question is, which nations are desirous of joining BRICS coalition? So we know that Argentina. Okay, once again, we are having this. All right. Is it clear? If there is a. Please let me know in the comments. I think there could be a lag right now. Yeah, there's a lag. There we go. One second. Let me try and fix that. Let's see. Lag. I think there is still lag once again. One second. Just give me a second. Let me fix it. If I can. Hackers? Somebody is saying there are hackers who are making the connection unstable. Video lag, audio is better. One second. Let me. Are you able to see me? I think it's still lagging. One second. Yeah, it looks like this. Call Elon Musk. Is it still lagging? Clear lagging. Oh, man. This is annoying. Just give me a. All right, I think we are back online, on track. I think we're back on track. I apologize for that lag. I think we are fine. Yeah, just let me know if it is fine now. Yeah, I think it looks fine now. Okay, so let me resume that topic. I think I'm visible now. Okay, yeah, sometimes we get these technical issues, but yeah, let's continue. So we are talking about BRICS expansion. There are reports of BRICS being expanded. So let me put that on the screen once again, the news report of that. BRICS nations. So this is a news report from some time ago. This is from a few months ago. It's from June 24 this year. It says that the BRICS nations are continuing discussion on the expansion process. The leaders of the five nations will continue to discuss the possibility of admitting new countries to the grouping on the basis of full consultation and consensus. And there is progress happening in this direction and so on and so forth. So this is a report from June this year. So what are the nations that could possibly join BRICS? So we know that Argentina has applied to join BRICS. We know that Iran has also applied to join BRICS. And recently we have come to know that Algeria, the North African nation of Algeria, has also applied to join BRICS. And we also heard recently that Saudi Arabia is quite interested in joining the BRICS grouping. So the BRICS group is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, right? And now if all these nations enter it, I think they'll still call it BRICS. So what is the significance of all this? So Algeria, for instance, which is the latest nation that has applied to join BRICS, is Europe's largest provider of natural gas after Russia and Norway. And it's the 11th largest nation. It's the nation with the 11th largest gas reserves in the world, right? And if BRICS already is a significant grouping of nations, and if all these nations also become part of it, then it will become even more significant. So we have Algeria, we have Argentina, we have Iran, we have Saudi Arabia. One also hears that Turkey is interested, Egypt is interested, Afghanistan is interested. And one also hears that Indonesia may make a formal application to join BRICS at the upcoming G20 summit in Bali, which is next week. Yeah, 15th and 16th November. So it looks like lots of nations are very interested in joining BRICS. Now let's put another news report on the screen. Yeah, it's about the reserve currency. So it's not only that these nations want to join BRICS, but BRICS is now exploring the possibility of creating a new reserve currency. Now, what does that mean? And first of all, let's understand why are nations so interested in joining BRICS? The major nation, the largest economy in BRICS is China. And we know that after the pandemic, nations are kind of wary of China. Nations don't trust China anymore the way they may have used to trust China before the pandemic. So what's happening is that we are witnessing multipolarity, the emergence of multipolarity. The Russians call it a polycentric world order, but we are witnessing a significant movement of the global order towards multipolarity or polycentrism. Now, who is driving this multipolarity? Who is driving it? Is China driving the multipolarity? No, it's not China that's driving the multipolarity. China is kind of stagnating as an economic power. Right now, what we are witnessing is that Russia is driving the multipolarity of the world. Russia has emerged it's kind of re-emerging as a major power, if not a superpower. It's got the most powerful nuclear arsenal in the world. It controls the largest land area in the world of any nation. And it controls almost half of the world's resources. Right? And Russia is standing up against NATO, and it is essentially right now driving the multipolar world order. That's what Russia is doing. So India is kind of in some way aligning itself to a certain extent with Russia. India is also aligning itself with the United States when it comes to the Quad and various other things. So we are witnessing multipolarism, and we are witnessing the world is kind of gravitating towards BRICS right now for a variety of reasons. First of all, there is a sense in the world that America, the United States, could be a declining world power. We are witnessing signs of that. We are seeing signs of that. And we are witnessing that Russia is rising again after a very long time. And India is also rising. And China is also kind of declining, or not rising the way we would have expected it to rise. So we are witnessing this age of confusion. And we are witnessing cooperation between these three nations, essentially. India, China, Russia. And the entire process is kind of being driven by Russia. We know that China and Russia don't trust each other. We know that India and China don't trust each other. India and Russia, to a large extent, I would say, can trust each other. So what is BRICS? I would say, to use physics terminology, BRICS is a metastable reconfiguration of the world order. It is not always going to remain in the shape and form that it is. It's going to be driven by the three major nations, India, China, Russia. But it's not the final form of the world order. In 20, 30 years, we may witness a different kind of, entirely different kind of world order. But right now, BRICS is extremely relevant. It's extremely attractive to nations that want to move away from the US hegemony. And that's where the BRICS reserve currency comes in. So if BRICS creates its own reserve currency, what does it mean for the world? Right now, the world's only reserve currency, the major currency in the world, is the US dollar. The US has its hegemony over the world through its economic might, and because the US dollar is the world's reserve currency. So essentially, the world's nations are subsidizing US dollar printing and US debt. The United States is the most indebted nation in the world. Let's take a look at, so what is US debt? The US is the most indebted nation in the world. Let's take a look at the US national debt, what it looks like. Let's try and understand what all this is. So a nation that is incredibly indebted, how is it so powerful? The US national debt, clock how its warning affects you. So the national debt clock of tracks the US debt, which surpassed $31 trillion in October 2022. The US debt, which it owes to other nations and also internally to some extent, the US debt is in excess of $31 trillion. India's annual GDP is about $3+ something trillion. The US national debt is in excess of $31 trillion, right? Let's compare that with the US GDP. Let's take a look at what the US GDP is like. The total debt is $31+ trillion, and the GDP is $23 trillion. So the debt to GDP ratio is ridiculously skewed. I think Japan has a worse ratio, but Japan is a US, well, you know what it is. So the US national debt exceeds significantly the US annual GDP, which is incredible, right? So how is this sustainable, you will ask me? And what exactly is the US external debt? The US external debt is in the form of these treasury notes. So nations, they buy, and even individuals can buy US treasuries. It's a kind of investment. Because the US dollar is the world's reserve currency, that's why it is regarded, the entire international financial system is built around an idea. The idea that the US treasury bonds are a safe asset. And any individual can buy US treasury notes and bonds. Yeah, the minimum purchase is $100. And nations even buy it as a safe investment. So what does all this mean? When a nation, let's say India, buys $100 million of US treasury notes, it's essentially buying US debt. It means that India will get this 4.125% interest on that. And whenever India decides to sell it back to the US, the Americans have to give India that much US dollar, you know, that much currency. Now, the US national debt is a mirage. It's an illusion. It means nothing. The US doesn't ever have to pay back the debt. Why do I make this incredibly ridiculous, apparently, statement? The United States does not ever have to pay back its debt. Why is that so? It's because the US national debt to other nations is in the US national currency, the US dollar. So let's say a nation goes to the US and says that you owe me $100 billion. What will the US do? They will simply print $100 billion in notes and give it to the nation. They only have to print paper money. That's all it is. But when India, let's say, for example, India owes hypothetically another nation $100 billion, India owes that in US dollars, not in Indian rupees, which means that it has to actually produce that amount of goods or whatever to earn those $100 billion, and then India can repay it. So when a non-US nation owes an external debt in US dollars, that nation has to first earn US dollars and then repay the debt. In the case of the US, it can simply print the money. It controls the global reserve currency, which is what gives you the US this incredible hegemony over the entire world. The US has leveraged its reserve currency status to sanction other nations and to freeze their assets. So in the case we have a BRICS currency, it's going to be a challenge to the hegemony of the United States and of the US dollar. And in a system where you have multiple reserve currencies or multiple major currencies, no single nation can sanction another nation or freeze the assets of that nation, right? So if BRICS comes up with a BRICS reserve currency, it is a direct challenge to the superpower. It is a direct challenge to the monopoly that the United States has over the global financial system. And it's going to have repercussions. The US will not take such a challenge lying down. It's going to push back in a variety of ways. So yeah, but we are seeing these reports of BRICS thinking about creating a BRICS reserve currency, which will be based on a basket of currencies and commodities and things like that. I will not go into those things. So we could be witnessing an attempt to create a competitor to the US dollar, a competing reserve currency. This could cause a bifurcation of the global system, of a bifurcation of the world order, and it could set essentially the United States against the BRICS nations. And if more and more nations are now interested in joining BRICS, it would indicate that more and more nations are seeing the US as a declining nation, as a declining power, and they possibly want to throw in their lot with the other group of nations. And maybe it means that they are tired of being bullied and pushed around by the US, and maybe tired of US hegemony. So and some of these nations, like Saudi Arabia, are essentially owned by the US, right? Saudi Arabia, I have described it in the past as a US vassal state. It's termed by the Americans as a US ally, as a major ally, or I don't know what else. Turkey is a member of NATO. If Turkey actually wants to join BRICS, that will be a major challenge to the US from within NATO. It's like a rebellion from within, right? It's like a vassal state saying that I am no longer a vassal. I'm not going to, you know, do whatever you dictate. So that's what we are seeing. Even Egypt is very closely aligned with the US. It has been for a long time. Yeah. Indonesia. Yeah, well, if you look at the history of Indonesia, 1950s, 1960s onwards, you will see a lot of US involvement, which people may not know about. So this is what we are seeing. The question is, how stable is BRICS? We have the India-China conflict that dates back to the 1950s, and the Chinese have been the aggressor all the time. Can India and China put their differences aside? Can India trust China? I would say not. So the question is, how viable is BRICS? The question is of the viability, long-term viability of BRICS. As long as India and China are adversaries, it is difficult to imagine BRICS, you know, becoming strong enough to take on the might of the sole existing superpower in the world. So yeah, we are going through interesting times, but yeah, if the BRICS coalition does accept new members and does come up with its own currency, yeah, reserve currency, then things could get really interesting, and you could see a significant reaction from the US, maybe very strong measures taken by the US against these nations. So that's where we are. So that is about BRICS. BRICS and the possibility of new nations, more nations coming into the organization, into the coalition, I would not call it an alliance. It's a coalition of a kind of like-minded nations. Who's the leader right now? There are three major nations. None of them has actually said that I am the leader. But the Chinese would like to be seen as the leader. But right now, the Chinese are not so much in a leadership position. India is not claiming leadership, but Russia is driving everything right now. And more nations are attracted towards this. And they want to join it. And there could be a reserve currency coming up. So very interesting times that we are living in. The next few months, next couple of years could throw us a lot, could give us a lot more clarity on where this is all going to go. How many nations become part of BRICS? And does BRICS actually do the unthinkable, take the plunge, and come up with its own reserve currency? Time will tell us, but things seem to be moving in that direction. So let's keep an eye on this again, on this as well, and we will revisit this at an appropriate time. Right. So that is about BRICS. Now let's talk about the US midterm elections. So November 8th was the day. Today is November 12th. So on November 8th, the US had its midterm elections. So the results of the elections are still not entirely declared. And the results have been actually quite surprising. Some people are calling the US midterms as a referendum. They're terming it a referendum on Donald Trump and various things. Things like that. And the results have been surprising. It's still not clear who's going to control the House of Representatives, who's going to control the Senate and all that. It's still up for grabs. So do we have any results on the screen? Let me see. Yeah, let me put this on the screen. Let me do it very rapidly. The results of the midterm elections, we still don't have clarity. Here we are. Okay. So now let me explain, give you some context as to what the US system is like. So in the US, you have two houses of Congress. In India, in the parliament, we have an upper house and a lower house. The upper house is called the Rajya Sabha. The lower house is called the Lok Sabha. Yes. In the US, there are two houses of Congress. The lower house is called the House of Representatives. And the upper house is called the US Senate. Yes. So the US Senate has 100 seats. 100 seats. Each member of the Senate has a six-year term. Each member of the Senate, of the US Senate, has a six-year term. So in the US Senate with 100 seats, for a majority, you need 51 seats. And the US Vice President is the de facto or ex officio president of the Senate. And the US Vice President may cast a tiebreaker vote in case it is needed. And there is a special kind of thing. It's called a filibuster, so what this means is that you need 60 votes in the US Senate to pass a law. The lower house is called the US House of Representatives, which has currently 435 seats. Each of the members of the House of Representatives has only a two-year term. They don't have a four-year term or a six-year term. They only have a two-year term. And in the House of Representatives, for a majority in the House, you need 218 seats. And obviously, the party that gets the majority gets to select the Speaker of the House. So after the 2020 elections, the control of the House, the House of Representatives, the control of the Senate, and the presidency all have resided with the Democrats. The Democrats control everything. The president of the US is a Democrat. The Senate has a Democratic majority, and the House of Representatives has a Democratic majority. Right? In the US, obviously, as you know, I think you know, there is a two-party system. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party are the two major parties, the only two parties that really matter. There are some other parties like the Libertarian Party, the Green Party, the Constitution Party, and other things, but they are essentially irrelevant. So the US is a two-party system. It's a two-party state. Democrats and Republicans, Joe Biden, who was elected in 2020, is a Democrat. Before him, you had Trump, who was elected in 2016, who was a Republican. Obama was a Democrat. George W. Bush was Republican. Bill Clinton was a Democrat. George H.W. Bush was a Republican. Reagan was a Republican, and so on and so forth, right? So now, in this election, the midterm elections, The Republicans had anticipated what they called a red wave or a red tsunami. They had anticipated that they would pick up more than 30 seats on top of what they already had. And they had anticipated an overwhelming majority in this election. Now look at this, what's happened. In the U.S. Senate, for majority unit 51, it's 47-48. GOP means the Republicans. They have 48 seats right now. How many seats are still not announced? There are three seats for which the election has not been called yet. Nevada is one, Alaska is one, and there should be one more somewhere else. When it comes to the U.S. House of Representatives, it's 199 to the Democrats, 211 for the Republicans. For a majority, you need 218. And there are some states where it has not been announced yet. So it's going on and on. And this is something that's peculiar to the American electoral system. In India, once the election, on the day that the election results are announced, everything is announced on the same day because we have electronic voting. In the US, it's a whole different and very interesting system. Yeah. So this is where we are. So the Republicans had anticipated a red wave, a red tsunami. They had anticipated an overwhelming majority. It's not happened. It is not happened. This is a huge relief for the Democrats. It's a huge relief for Joe Biden. It's they have seen better than expected results, the Democrats, in many places. And it's now very clear that the Democrats, their biggest fear has not come true. They will not concede dozens of seats in the House or in the Senate, especially in the House. Yeah. So what could happen is we could still see a narrow Republican majority. This could still happen. So this would give them effective veto power. If they are able to acquire a narrow majority in the House and in the Senate, yeah, let's say it happens, this would give them essentially veto power over any legislation that is introduced in the House. So they will be able to veto any legislation that the Democrats introduce and try to move forward in the House. This will essentially make it very difficult for the Democrats to govern the United States. Yeah. And now what does this mean for Donald Trump? What does it mean for the MAGA movement, Make America Great Again? So understand this from Donald Trump's perspective. Like, lots of people are expecting or anticipating that Donald Trump will run again. Yeah. And he could run for the 2024 election coming up soon. Understand this. This is the third straight election in which Donald Trump has come up short. In the 2018 midterm elections, the Democrats won the House. They gained 41 seats. And the Republicans, I think they retained the Senate. That's in the 2018 midterm elections. So the Democrats were able to win the House of Representatives, and the Republicans, they retained the Senate, the upper house. So this can be viewed as a rejection of Trump, because at that time Trump was the incumbent sitting president. So that's 2018, in which Trump essentially came up short. In the 2020 elections, Trump lost the presidential election. Joe Biden won, right? We know that's what happened. And in the 2020 elections, the Democrats were able to win the Senate as well. So the Democrats won the presidency, they retained the House, and they won the Senate. That's 2020. In the 2022 midterm elections, which we are seeing right now, the results on the screen right now, there is a possible slim majority or a razor-thin majority for the Republicans. Possibly, we still have to see that. It's not the red wave that Trump was talking about. It's not the red wave that the Republicans were anticipating. Yeah. So Donald Trump's political graph doesn't seem to be doing very well. We could see right now, Donald Trump is said to be still the number one candidate for a Republican nomination for the 2024 election. But now we are seeing some challengers. One of the challengers is the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, who is a young man. He's in his early 40s. That's very young for a politician. Yeah. He's won a big victory in Florida, as you can see. This is Florida. He's won a big victory there. One second. Senate, governor. Yeah. Oh, here. Ron DeSantis. It's a massive 19-point victory that he has won. So that makes him a strong potential rival and challenger to Trump. He is possibly Donald Trump's top challenger for the Republican nomination for 2024. And Donald Trump seems to understand this. And he, I think, recently disparaged Ron DeSantis by calling him Ron DeSanctimonious or something like that. And another potential outsider who could challenge Trump could be the governor of Maryland, who is Larry Hogan. Yeah, he could take the Republicans on a new path. So that's these are the possibilities that we could see, that we could witness. One hears that Trump may possibly announce his candidacy. He may throw his hat in the ring for the 2024 presidential candidacy very soon, maybe as early as next week. Yeah. And we are also hearing that his closest advisors and his closest, the two closest people to him politically are his daughter Ivanka Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner. And they were his top advisors when he was president. Now, it appears that the two of them are not interested in continuing in politics and they may not be part of his campaign. So that could be a setback to him. That's what we are hearing. That's what the news is. That's the news that's being reported. We're not quite sure. Yep. So it still remains to be seen what happens. Yeah. So it is possible that Donald Trump may announce his candidacy as early as next week. But will he be able to gain the Republican nomination or will he face a significant challenge from people like Ron DeSantis and Larry Hogan? It also needs to be seen. So the top questions are, firstly, who will lead the Republicans in the next presidential race, and also who will lead the Democrats in the next presidential race? Because it looks unlikely that Joe Biden may run again for president, even though he's the sitting president, and typically a sitting president will run for re-election. But it may be unlikely, because Biden, as we know, is an elderly person. Yeah. And so will it be Kamala Harris? Will it be somebody else? Or will it be Joe Biden himself? Who will lead the Democrats in the next presidential race? That is something that we still don't know, and it remains to be seen. If the Republicans win a razor-thin majority in the House and the Senate, will Biden become a lame duck president, a president only in name? Because when a political party has control of the lower house, the House of Representatives, they are able to launch all kinds of investigations into the ruling party. So will the Republicans launch investigations about Hunter Biden, about, for instance, the withdrawal of the U.S. armed forces from Afghanistan, which was a complete disaster, and so on and so forth, into Joe Biden himself, into his functioning and various things? So you could witness, if the Republicans are able to win the lower house, you could witness all kinds of investigations coming up into these matters, right? And there could even be the possibility of a government shutdown like we have seen before in the US, in the United States. So all these possibilities are in front of us. Somebody is saying, what about Tulsi Gabbard? Tulsi Gabbard has left. She has quit the Democratic Party. So she is right now no longer politically active, as that's what it looks like. But she's very active on the media, on social media and so on. So Tulsi Gabbard is not a factor right now. Yeah. So that's where we are. So what does it mean for India? It means, right, see, historically, in recent history, the Republicans have been, in a sense, kind of slightly more pro-India than the Democrats. Their policies have been slightly more favorable. The Republicans, their policies, whenever there's been a Republican president, the policies have been kind of more favorable towards India as compared to the policies of the United States when there is a Democrat who is the president. For instance, Barack Obama. So, that's recent history. Like more recently, like 10, 20, 30, the past 10, 20, 30 years. So in case the Republicans win the lower house in the Senate, then this could make it very interesting. Yeah. Obviously, Joe Biden will still be the president of the US, and the overall policies and all will be framed by the Democrats. So it's interesting times for India. For the US primarily, but from India, we need to watch this very closely because it's going to affect India-US relations. Joe Biden, as you know, as president, he has not appointed an ambassador to India, a US ambassador to India for almost 2 years. The position is lying vacant, which kind of indicates that the US doesn't, that this current administration is not very interested in having good relations with India. And maybe it's kind of sending some messages to the Indian government and trying to, you know, exert some kind of pressure on the Indian government. So clearly, relations are not very good right now. In case Trump runs again, or in case there is a strong Republican candidate for 2024, then things could be different. But that's where we are. So right now, it's a very confusing time from the U.S. perspective. There is still not enough clarity about who's going to win the House, who's going to win the Senate. As you can see, the House is still in limbo. The Republicans seem to be inching towards a majority. In the Senate, it's even tighter. Yeah. So that's the situation that we are witnessing. And this is all going to have a direct impact sooner or later on India-US relations. Yeah. So yeah, that's where we are. I think by the time we do the next Indian Interest live stream, we will have more clarity on this. So we will revisit this in the next live stream. Right. So now let me bring this all right. So let's remove that. Now the question, what is the question? Let's talk about China. We need to talk about China, and it's something we need to talk about regularly. So let's put a news report on the screen and let's see what it means. So the news report is this. Xi Jinping tells China's army to focus on war preparation. So he had earlier warned of dangerous storms on the horizon in the Communist Party Congress that has concluded recently, and so on. And you can see the Chinese president and his the top leadership all wearing military uniforms, which is quite unusual. So what does this mean? Why is Xi Jinping telling the Chinese army, the so-called People's Liberation Army, to focus on war preparation? So, Mr. Xi Jinping is reasonably young. He's 69 years old. Yeah, so he's not very old. So one could expect him to possibly last the next 5 years, maybe even 10 years, possibly, if he is able to cling on to power. So, Mr. Xi Jinping, he currently holds the top three posts in China. He has been reappointed very recently as the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. He is also the head of the Central Military Commission, which is the high command of the PLA, the People's Republic Army. And he's the President of China, right? So these are the three top positions in the whole of China. And he holds all these three top positions. Now, Xi Jinping is a very ambitious person. He came to power in 2014. Yes, 2014, was it? 2012, sorry, 2012. And he has inculcated the idea of a Chinese dream, what he calls a Chinese dream, in the Chinese people. The idea of the Chinese dream is of restored national greatness by mid-century, by the middle of the 21st century. He wants restored national greatness for China, which, what does it mean? It means that China should replace and displace the US as the world's only superpower. That is the great ambition of Xi Jinping, right? So that is the kind of man he is. He has consolidated his power over the Chinese Communist Party, over China. He has been elected for a third term, which is precedented. Yeah. And there is, from the perspective of the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese Armed Forces, they have a centennial goal. So the PLA was founded in 1927. So in 2027, it's going to become 100 years old, the organization, the army, the PLA. So the centennial goal of the PLA is to make the PLA a world-class armed force by 2027. What does that mean? It means they should establish or accomplish parity with the US military. That's just 5 years away. Will they be able to establish parity with the US military, with the US armed forces in just 5 years? Seems to be unlikely, but they already have a larger navy than the United States Navy. So yeah, things are interesting from that perspective. Okay? So Xi Jinping is asking his armed forces, is asking the PLA to focus on war preparation. He is saying there are storms on the horizon, the dangerous storms on the horizon for China. Now, what storms is he referring to? So, as a nation that is an aspiring superpower, as a nation that has a stated objective of replacing the US as the sole superpower by the middle of the century, the number one competitor, rival, adversary, whatever you want to call it, is going to be the US. So the dangerous storm that Xi Jinping is referring to could possibly refer to a potential possible future conflict with the US. Now, how would that's one possibility. How would that spark off? That could spark off, that sort of conflict could be sparked off by a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. We all know they have made no secret of this, that they wish to reunify Taiwan with the mainland. And they have said that we refuse to rule out the option of using military force for reunifying Taiwan with China. So in case the Chinese try to invade Taiwan and reunify the nation, the island by force, that would lead to a straightforward conflict with Taiwan and with the US possibly. Yeah. If the US does not intervene and try to bail Taiwan out, that would signal to the entire world that the US is no longer capable of countering China and is no longer essentially a superpower. That would be a tremendous crushing loss to the US prestige. Yeah. It would essentially mean the end of US hegemony. So if the Chinese target Taiwan, that could mean a war with the US, and the Chinese will not do this unless they are entirely 100% sure that they will succeed. So one of the possibilities of the focus of this war preparation could be about a potential future conflict in Taiwan in the next maybe 5 to 10 years, possibly. Yeah, that's one. The second major flashpoint the Chinese have is obviously with India. Let's go to the map, because as we know, the Chinese have refused to demarcate the India-China, the India-Tibet border. And they have been refusing to do this for a very, very long time. They want to keep this situation simmering. They want to keep the situation simmering. And they have been employing their good old tried and tested salami slicing tactics, you know, creeping normalcy, take 1 inch at a time, take 1 foot at a time, intrude here, intrude there, make all these incursions, keep India on the back foot and try to take small bite-sized pieces of territory out of Indian hands. That's what they've been doing along the entire border, which is an entirely disputed border. So that is a significant flashpoint, and that is obviously a major candidate for a future war, that the Chinese would get into a future war with India. That is a possibility. Yeah. Now, I have said that a few months ago, there is a significant possibility of India and China getting involved in some kind of conflict, you know, maybe a small, short, sharp war or whatever, before the 2024 elections in India. Because the Chinese would like to see a weak coalition government or a weak government come to power in New Delhi in 2024. They would definitely not want to see Mr. Modi re-elected. And one of the ways of ensuring that a re-election of Mr. Modi doesn't happen is by, if they can, inflict a defeat, a military defeat on India, which would be seen as a national humiliation of the government and the prime minister. So that would make the possibility or the option of a quick, short, sharp war with India very attractive from the Chinese perspective. But now things have changed. You know, BRICS is becoming a big thing. And the Chinese economy is no longer rising or growing the way it was supposed to. The Belt and Road Initiative is like semi-dead right now. So the great rise of China is not happening the way they had anticipated. In that scenario, it does not make a lot of sense for them to start a conflict with India, which could also and possibly end up in a humiliation for China. It could boomerang on them. Yeah. So now it looks like the possibility of conflict between India and China is less than it would have been 6 months ago. And yet one has to be very careful. India has to be constantly alert and constantly on its toes, forever vigilant. So these are the two possibilities, either Taiwan or India, or maybe it's just a bluff. So when Mr. Xi Jinping says that be prepared for war, make preparations for war, it could indicate a possible future move on Taiwan, a possible future conflict with India. Certainly not with Russia right now, and certainly not with the US right now. The US is still too strong for the Chinese when it comes to the military perspective. So there are these possibilities, but there is always a possibility at any time of something happening along the disputed India-Tibet border. So India, from the perspective of India, India will have to remain extremely vigilant, keep eyes, ears open, keep the satellites 24/7 monitoring the situation along the Tibet border, and always be open to the possibility that the Chinese would be up to some mischief. It may be a bluff, but it could be a real thing. So India has to be forever vigilant as long as China occupies Tibet and as long as Pakistan exists, right? So yeah, that's about Mr. Xi Jinping and his call to arms for the China, for the People's Liberation Army, the so-called People's Liberation Army, PLA. What else is happening in the world? So yeah, I spoke about the G20 summit that's coming up. So this the G20 summit is coming up next week on Tuesday and Wednesday on the 15th and 16th of November 2022. The G20 summit is a yearly summit meeting. It's where all the leaders of the top 20 economies of the world, they come together and they meet each other and they have various discussions and negotiations and interesting conversations. So this year's summit is in Bali, in Indonesia. Bali is a Hindu majority island in Indonesia, very wonderful, very nice culture, and so on. So who all is attending? Joe Biden, the president of the US, is attending. Xi Jinping is attending. Mr. Modi, the prime minister of India, is attending. So we're going to witness a meeting between Joe Biden and Xi Jinping. I think it's going to be the first time these two meet actually face to face in person after Joe Biden became president. So there's going to be a Joe Biden-Xi Jinping meeting. There's going to be a Modi-Biden meeting as well. Mr. Modi and Mr. Biden are most likely going to meet and have some kind of discussion, conversation, and so on. There's going to be the first meeting between Mr. Modi and Mr. Rishi Sunak, the new prime minister, the newly installed prime minister of the UK. So that's going to be the first time, I think, that the two leaders are going to meet each other. And there is also going to be a meeting between Mr. Modi and Mr. Macron of France. They know each other very well and they have a very good relationship. So that's going to be a continuation of the good and very warm and positive Indo-France relationship, strategic partnership. Yeah. So that's what's going to happen. Mr. Putin is not going to go to Bali, right? In his place, Mr. Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, is going to go to Bali. He's going to be standing in for Mr. Putin. I don't think Mr. Putin is going to deliver any virtual address or anything. So Mr. Putin is going to be absent. And it's going to be Mr. Lavrov who's going to stand in for him and represent Mr. Putin and represent Russia at the G20 summit. Strangely enough, Mr. Zelensky is going to have a virtual presence in Bali. Even though Ukraine is not part of the G20, but they have made a special concession for him because of the special circumstances we are living through. And Mr. Zelensky is going to have a virtual presence in Bali, and he may deliver some kind of address or whatever. So he's going to be there. And there's going to be, who else? Mr. MBS, Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, with whom we have very good relations. Mr. Kishida, Fumio Kishida of Japan. The Chancellor of Germany, Mr. Olaf Scholz. Monsieur Trudeau is going to be there. Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. The great Mr. Erdogan is going to be there. Australia will be represented by their Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese. The new Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni, is going to be there. And we're not sure about Brazil, because there's the new elections in Brazil. Mr. Lula has become the new leader of Brazil. And there's some kind of uncertainty there. So we're not quite sure if Brazil will be represented at the G20 summit. But the customary family portrait where all the leaders stand together and there's this big group picture that is typically taken every time, that is not going to happen. Because Mr. Lavrov is going to be there. And the Western nations don't want to pose for a photograph with Mr. Sergei Lavrov or anybody from Russia. So Bali is considered to be a paradise. It's so beautiful and so nice that it's considered to be a paradise kind of island. There is trouble in paradise. There are all these things happening. Yeah. So that's about the G20 summit, which is going to happen in just a couple of days, 2-3 days from now. Yeah. And let's see what are the outcomes of the summit. Mr. Modi is definitely going there, and he's going to make it a point to meet, especially, I'm not sure if he's going to meet Mr. Xi Jinping. The India-China relationship is still not back. It's still not a normal relationship. Yeah. After 2020, after the Galwan clashes and all that, it's a rather strained relationship, even though these two nations are two of the three major nations in BRICS and very important nations. There may not be a face-to-face meeting between Mr. Xi Jinping and Mr. Modi. So let's see how it goes. Will there be a meeting? Will there not be a meeting? We don't know. Let's wait and watch. And we may have some interesting outcomes of this summit. So we're going to keep an eye on that as well. And I will report about this again and analyze it in the next episode of the Indian Interest. Yeah. So now the final thing I want to talk about is Twitter. I'm on Twitter. I'm sure most of you are on Twitter. Twitter is it's not the biggest social media platform in the world, but it seems to be the most interesting social media platform right now. And as we know, recently, Elon Musk has acquired Twitter. And there's a lot of interesting things happening on Twitter, within Twitter, in the company and so on. So we know that we recently came to know that over 90% of the India staff of Twitter has been fired. The Indian staff was about 200 employees. Over 90% of those employees have been fired. I think only 10 or 12 or 15 or something like that are left. So that's very interesting. And as we know, Indian Twitter India was extremely biased in its treatment of various people. People on the platform. It was extremely politically oriented in a certain direction. It was very rough and very biased against what in India they call the right wing, the so-called right wing. It was extremely pro-left wing and extremely anti-right wing. Lots of people were banned or blocked for no reason whatsoever. Some people were banned permanently, and things like that, you know. And there was a lot of double standards and all that. So that 90% of the India staff of Twitter has been fired. And there have been big layoffs. So within India, the entire communications team of Indian Twitter has been fired. A majority of the public policy team, which was the liaison between Twitter India and the government of India, much of that has been fired. And the product team, most of it has been fired and so on. So, and there's been a massive reduction of the staff across Twitter in various geographies, in Asia Pacific, in Africa, Latin America, Middle East, in North America and so on. Yeah. So that's what's happening. And what's interesting is that in the US, 99% of Twitter employees vote for the Democratic Party. So it's an incredibly biased organization. There's no balance. Typically in the US, you have 50-50 split in the US population. Approximately 50-50% vote Democrat and 50% vote Republican. But within Twitter, almost 99% vote Democrat, which is an example of incredible bias, political bias in an organization. So Elon Musk is getting rid of most of these people. Yeah. There was this guy called Yoel Roth, who was the head of trust and safety on Twitter. He himself, if you look at his tweets, you can see the bias shining through very clearly. So initially, Mr. Musk said that he has full confidence in Yoel Roth, but just a couple of days ago he was fired. So Musk used him for whatever he needed him for, and then he got rid of this guy. And that's what's happened to a lot of the leadership. We know what happened to Mr. Parag Agarwal and various other people, right? To what's her name, Vijaya Gadde, and other very, very famous luminaries of Twitter. They're all gone now. Mr. Musk has taken full control of Twitter. What's interesting is that he has brought in outside leadership, you know, people he trusts into the organization on a temporary basis, just to look at what's right, what's wrong, and in what direction he needs to take the company towards. What's also interesting is that he has imported some Tesla programmers into Twitter. So Tesla is the organization that he runs. He has like a number of companies that he runs: SpaceX, Tesla, there's a solar company as well. Yeah. So in Tesla, he has lots of programmers, obviously. Yeah. And Tesla has incredibly high standards. We know that. Tesla is not really a car manufacturing company. It's a battery manufacturing company, if you look at it in from the right perspective. Anyhow, they have excellent programmers there. He has brought in programmers from Tesla into Twitter to examine the code of Twitter, what the Twitter programmers have been doing, engineers have been doing. And these Tesla programmers, engineers are going to look at the code and they're going to possibly improve it and build upon it. So Twitter right now is going through a whole lot of experimentation. Features are being put up and pulled down. So the Twitter Blue has been introduced, you know, the $8. The blue tick will now become accessible to everybody, but it will cost $8. Elon Musk said that it will be purchasing parity power, whatever it is, PPP, adjusted by country. But now that it has come in India, it seems to be costing more than $8 in Indian rupees. And I hear that today the option of buying the blue tick has disappeared from Twitter. So we know what was happening. A lot of people were acquiring the blue tick for $8, and they were putting out very hilarious tweets, yeah, just to make fun of how things are. You know, they were impersonating various organizations and companies and putting out hilarious tweets. So right now they are seem to be cracking down on that. It was good fun while it lasted. So right now the blue tick is not available, maybe not for the next few days, until they can figure out a way of, you know, ensuring this sort of impersonation and all that doesn't happen. So that's one thing. But Twitter is experimenting with a whole lot of features in doing all that right now. Another thing that Elon Musk spoke about, let me put the tweet on the screen. He said that, one second, let me put that. It's an interesting exchange that he had on Twitter. So Elon Musk is going to make Twitter a good place for content creators, and they're going to be able to monetize their content. So somebody said that if Twitter could handle the full-length feature videos I can produce and so on. So right now, Twitter can do 42-minute chunks of 1080p resolution for the new blue. And that 42-minute limit will be gone, will be fixed by next month. And he asked about YouTube monetization. And somebody said that YouTube gives creators 55% of ad revenue. And Elon Musk says that we can beat that, which could be very exciting for people who are into the content creation business industry, whatever it is. Twitter could become possibly even more lucrative or generate better revenues than YouTube possibly. So that is what Elon Musk is essentially saying that he will do. Yeah. So interesting times for Twitter. And there's this guy, podcast host and entrepreneur called Patrick Bet David. David, he has this YouTube channel called Valuetainment, a very, very interesting channel. Worth watching. So Patrick Bet David recently said that Twitter could potentially in the next 2 to 5 years become a $1 trillion company. Elon Musk knows how to fix companies. He knows how to make money. And he is not in this for just fun and games. Yeah, he acts like a big child very often, I think on a daily basis, Elon Musk. If you look at his tweets, it's quite funny. But he is deadly serious when it comes to making money. And if he does the right things with Twitter, and he will have lots of innovative ideas and all that, then you could see Twitter in the next few years become a $1 trillion company possibly. So that's what Patrick Bet David said. And let's see if that turns out to be true, you know. So I think that overall Twitter will become a better place. Lots of people are upset. Lots of people especially those who already have blue ticks, they are upset about having to pay for the blue tick, and they're more upset about the fact that everybody can get a blue tick now if they pay $8. The other interesting and important thing is this: when you are using a service and that service is free, then you are the product. They are monetizing you. They are monetizing your data. When a service is free, it means the service is not the product. You are the product. But when you are paying for a service, you are no longer the product. At least you should not be, you know? So yeah, it's interesting to see the direction that Twitter is going in. They're going to crack down on bots. They're going to crack down on inactive accounts. They may crack down at some point on anonymous accounts. And eventually maybe everybody will have blue ticks, and maybe everybody, maybe everybody will be a paying customer. So Twitter is going to be monetized fully, and it's going to also give back and produce lots of new features and all that. And I think the blatant political bias that we had and extremely high-handed policies that they had, that is now going to disappear, or at least it's going to be reduced in intensity, which could be good news for the people in India who use Twitter, because we know how what kind of policies Twitter has had for the past few years. They even forced Indian MPs, sitting MPs, to delete tweets. They locked the accounts. You know, this, I think this happened to, if I'm not mistaken, Paresh Rawal once. I think he's an MP, right? And it's happened to other MPs as well. Members of parliament who are currently in office, they were made, their accounts were locked and they were made to delete tweets. And they would, their accounts were not unlocked until they deleted tweets. So this sort of thing, this sort of behavior was quite rampant during the pre-Elon Musk days. So hopefully things will be better as we go forward. So yeah, that's about Twitter. And that is the end of today's episode. That's what I wanted to speak about. Yeah. So thank you for watching. And we will keep on, we will keep a close eye on these and other topics and issues. And yeah, so if you have any questions, you know what to do about that. And I will see you in tomorrow's Ask Abhijit live stream. Until then, take care. Thank you very much. Good night, good day. I'll see you soon. Bye.